straight out of Austin, Texas. It's On Second Thought, powered by Hook'em.com, with your hosts, Statesman sports columnists Cedric Golden and Kirk Bowles. Often imitated, never duplicated. Hear it here first, On Second Thought.
On Second Thought, brought to you by Hook'em.com and our good friends at Bud Light. I'm Cedric Golden, and I'm joined by the Dutch Kirk Bowles. Jam-packed podcast commemorating number 200, dog. Number 200.
Oh,
dog. We could have lasted 200 episodes.
Yeah. Is anybody listening for the last 2 years? No. Okay. All right.
No.
Well, at least we're still doing it.
Well,
we're abusing ourselves.
Yeah, my dad's listening, but he's in heaven, so I don't think that click counts, but that's okay. I'm going to tell you, though, I'm mentioning my dad. My dad, he passed away in May of 2016, and we had just gotten this podcast up and going, and we end up going to the Big 12 Media Days in Dallas, and CBS Sports national writer Dennis Dodd was our first road guest, and we've been rolling ever since. We've got longtime national golf writer Melanie Hauser is going to be joining us later, along with TexAg's columnist Olin Buchanan. Those are a couple of Statesman alums. The Longhorns are off this week, as are 8 SEC teams because of the COVID, but we'll discuss that later. But, Duck, about this 200, man, what stands out to you? I mean, because we talked about doing a podcast for months before we finally did it. And then once we jumped in there, we haven't stopped moving since.
Well, it's one of the most fun parts of our week. And you and I love to talk about sports and argue sports. And, you know, it's been fun correcting you on podcasts
whatever
the last 5 years. So I don't know. It's funny because we've done it all over the place. We've taken it on the road to Super Bowls. You know, we've one of us has been on the road, and I remember once the maid interrupted us in Miami and walked in on us. So I remember that was pretty memorable.
I was like, "Yeah, I'll call you back in 15 minutes."
Yeah, well, you got to do what you got to do, right?
Oh man, you got to do what you got to do.
I just thank all our guests. I mean, we've had everybody from Brent Musburger to Jim Nance to Vern Lundquist to, you know, Bob Stoops, Barry Switzer, Earl Campbell. Just go down the list of some all-time
Mac players. Brown, the Longhorn legends. We've had some really fun Longhorn guests. Mac Brown, Earl Campbell, Roy Williams, Roderick Babers, who we just love. Brian Robinson, Tim Crowder, Aaron Ross, Michael Griffin. I mean, you name them and we've had them. And it's just been so much fun because these people let their hair down after they leave college. And they realize that those two columnists at the Statesman aren't out to get them. We're actually, well, no, we aren't. We're not out to get them, and we're actually not as bad as originally thought when they were in college.
Yeah, it's been so much fun, and like you know, you like it when people are kind of honest. And I remember Dave Faraday. How much fun!
Oh my God, that was the most. That may have been the most I've ever laughed on this podcast. He was hysterical. I might have to go back and listen to that one.
Yeah,
he was hysterical.
I almost wish we could compile our top 10 and put it out there in mass. And here's the thing. Okay, before we get to our next 100 to get to 300, who do you want? Name, and this is off the top of my head too, off the cuff. Who would we need to get before we hit 300?
I know who I want is Charles Barkley. I really want Charles Barkley. If we can get Charles Barkley on the podcast for 15 or 20 minutes,
right.
You know, and his dance card is so filled up, Duck, because all the national radio and television people have figured out what everybody knows for sure is that he's gold.
Mm-hmm.
He's absolute gold. So it will be Chuck. He's on my wish list.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm trying to think. I'd like to have Tiger Woods on. He'd be, I think he'd be fun. Probably not going to get Tiger anytime soon.
No, we got a better chance of getting Chuck than we do of getting Tiger.
Yeah, I think so.
We just do.
Well, we've tried to get Rick Neuheisel on. He keeps dodging us for some reason.
I stopped trying on Rick.
I'd like to get him on. So
Chris Sims refuses to come on.
Yeah, that's right.
I've sent him many, many text messages.
Ricky Williams hadn't been on.
Rick, we've openly talked to Rick. Rick, you want to be on the podcast? Yeah. Give me a call. Yeah. And he just won't do it.
Oh, maybe we should ask Vince Young to be on sometime.
VY would be an interesting one. I wouldn't mind having VY on. Yeah. That would be good.
Reach out to him before we hit 300.
You know, I'd like to get Karen Aston back on. She's not coaching this year, I don't think, unless she's got an assistant's job that I don't know about. And she's posting a lot of stuff on her Facebook page of her family, just beautiful family. And I would love to see what she's up to, because before we really got rolling, Karen Aston was always down to do the podcast, and I will always be thankful and grateful to her that she would always take time out. Even after a game, we'd had our equipment in the hall in the bowels of the Irwin Center right before the NCAA tournament, and she graciously consented to do it. And I've always admired her for that.
I think she got an assistant's job up at one of the Michigan schools, I think.
Did she really? Maybe we need to get her before basketball season. I would love to get her. I always like Karen, love talking ball with her. We would exchange text messages during the WNBA finals or the NCAA Final Four, Women's Final Four, because she loves talking ball. And, whatever you think of what happened here at Texas, you know, not getting over the Baylor hump or anything, I've always had profound respect for Karen.
I'd also like to get Kim Mulkey on. We've never had her on our podcast.
Wow. Let's just plan to do this right now.
Yeah.
How about a Mulkey Vic Schaefer combo platter the week they play one another? It'll have to be whenever they play. Hopefully it'll be on a Saturday. And we don't have to get them at the same time, but I would love to get them separately, because they're both great quotes. They're fun, gregarious people, and they're very passionate, and they win. I would love to do that.
I would too. I think that let's get on that. So, all right, well, we got some guests coming up. So
we got some guests coming up, and before we get to our guest, Duck, I just want to give a shout-out to our producers. Alyssa Vidalis was there at the beginning, guided us through some early times with the podcast, produced us. And our current guy, Adam Fish, has been wonderful, just creative and just a smart dude. Always takes care of us. Even when I mess up, Duck, he comes in, and you'd never know it by listening, but he fixes all of the mistakes, and he just does it with such a great, just such a great spirit and just a great attitude, and just love both of those people. And thanks to the Statesman and Statesman Radio for putting us on and letting us do us.
Absolutely. And I'm surprised we haven't had demand to go video as well, but now that I think about it, probably not. So
No. people who love podcasts listen. They don't watch. And I've done that research. And we'll continue to do the video with the Longhorn Unfiltered and Longhorns Confidential, because those are a hit on Facebook Live. But On Second Thoughts is a classic audio podcast, and I think we should keep it that way.
On Second Thoughts.
Well, Doc, enough football and enough, enough nostalgia. Let's get down to brass tacks on our 200th episode. A good friend of ours, Melanie Hauser, joins us. I know you and she are mourning this Thursday morning because you're not in Augusta, Georgia. How many Masters have you two covered together, Mel?
Together? I'm not sure how many Kirk has. This would have been my 36th Masters. So that would have been really special. But I guess, Kirk, you've been there, I don't know, how many times?
Probably about 20. You know, I'm probably a little more than half as many as you. I wonder how many other writers have been to more Masters and covered more Masters than you. Yeah, other than maybe the late Dan Jenkins and, you know.
Oh, no, there's quite a few. There's actually quite a few. There were four that were going to hit the 40th this year. There's four more that are going to hit the 40th next year. There's probably about 15 people, you know, in that club so far. But there's not going to be many behind us with the way that things are going, just travel and things like that.
Well, what are your emotions? I'm dying inside. I'm going to watch every shot that I can, but I'm just dying that I'm not in Augusta. What emotions are you feeling?
Well, I'm kind of doing the same thing. I just got off the phone with somebody that's over there, and there are no ropes up, so they're able to walk down and be right there at Amen Corner. They said it's very, very, very different because they're going places that we've never been able to go before. It's just a very different Masters, but I miss it. I mean, you can't not miss something that's been part of your life for, you know, almost four decades. I got the opportunity to see some golf last week with the Houston Open, but it's just not the same. I mean, I miss the tree. I miss the egg salad and pimento sandwiches. I miss just being able to bump into some of the old timers there. When you've gone for that many years, you know the people in the clubhouse, you know the guys who work in the clubhouse. You stop by and say hi to them. I have my UPS buddies that FedEx UPS everything for me, from the dinner. They're just people that you see once a year, but you've gotten to know them so well over the years. And I think I miss, all of that. And plus just the excitement of the Masters. There's just something so totally different about that tournament. And, I have to say, the golf gods kind of put it all in perspective for me, because the very first Masters that I covered was Ben's first win. And I hadn't been able to go for so many years. And then I moved from the Statesman to the Houston Post, and they sent me, and it was just an amazing feeling because I was on the inside with Team Crenshaw the whole week. And, for that to be your first Masters and just to tumble down that way. And of course I took a lot of teasing. Well, it took you getting you to the Masters for Ben to win. And I'm like, I don't think so. but for that to be my very first one was amazing. Big Charlie, his dad was there. One of those guys that, like Daryl Royal and all those people that walked through my life earlier on. They're bigger than life people, and to see that and to be able to take what Ben and Tom had told me all those years and to walk that golf course, it was like, oh wow, you know.
Well, if you guys don't know our esteemed guest, she is the she's not self described author. She is an author. She is a Statesman alum, and she's covered 100 majors, secretary of the Golf Writers Association, and she works for the Harris County Houston Sports Authority. And just like the duck and myself, she's a voter for the Texas Sports Hall of Fame. She's on the selection committee. Mel, could you tell our listeners about the first time you found out you were going to the Masters and your reaction to that?
It kind of came with the territory when I moved to the Post. It was just in my rotation. I knew I would be at every major. And so there was an excitement there. There was a, oh my gosh, where am I going to stay? How do I do this? Jimmy DeMeritt had set all the Texas writers up with a oh my gosh, it was an old truck stop hotel in a not so great part of Augusta. And so, you know, I had a room there. Skip Bayless was there. A lot of the other writers were there. You know, you're finding your way. I was there with Jack Gallagher, a crusty old columnist for the Houston Post. And
crusty.
You know, crusty.
He was.
And, it was amazing because suddenly I was seeing something that I'd seen on TV, but I guess I would say I was really excited, but the whole thing, the move to Houston brought so many other things into play. I'd done some, NFL when I was at the, Statesman, but suddenly I was pulled into NFL. I was pulled into Astros stuff. I was covering Southwest Conference. I was, you know, jetting here and there. And so it was just like this huge whirlwind. So actually getting to Augusta was very cool. And the first time I walked down to Amen Corner, it was like this explosion. And back then they called us chipmunks, because your first Masters, you're a chipmunk. You're like running everywhere. Ooh, 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 ooh. You know, ooh, there's Amen Corner. Ooh, ooh, ooh. You know, there's 18. Ooh, there's the clubhouse. Ooh, that's the tree. So you're scrambling everywhere for that first Masters. And that's kind of the way I was. But at the same time, I was focusing down because, you know, I had to worry about Ben and Tom. And quite honestly, I knew that Ben and his first wife had made the decision to divorce, and that kind of freed him up. I was told that early in the week by his dad, and I knew that that would take a weight off of his shoulders. And then to see it unfold was just incredible. So
that's so weird. Your first Masters, Ben won. My first Masters that I covered, Ben won.
That was the first one you did. Oh, wow.
Y'all should have quit. Y'all should have quit after that.
That one was a pretty amazing one too, Kirk. I mean, you know, I was on the phone with Ben and Tom that Sunday night. Ben was in Augusta. Tom was still in Austin.
Right.
I mean, you know, we saw that unfold. We saw everything. And I remember every day I was talking with Carl Jackson, his caddy. You just kind of started to feel something. And it was like, oh, my gosh.
You did.
You almost expected Tom to be the stronger one in that. And instead, it wound up being Ben. But, you know, two very emotional times in his life, he puts it aside and it fuels him to two Masters.
Yeah. It's such a special place for you and me, and obviously it is for Ben. I mean, I don't know if anybody loved that course more than Bobby Jones, but it may have been Ben Crenshaw, but you're right. I mean, I walked with Ben. He was like leading every day. So I did Ben every day, walking with Julie and Charlie, his brother and his wife, and Scotty Sayers and his wife, Julie. And it's just such a dynamic. And then, so to me, the most electric thing is being on that first tee on Thursday, and, you know, seeing the honorary golfers tee off, you know, Jack and Gary and Lee Elder will do it this year. So it's just the expectation of what's going to happen. There's so much anticipation, and it just seemed like it always lived up to the billing. And that's one of the things that it just gives me chills just thinking of, you know, watching Ben. That my first three Masters, Mel, were Ben winning for the second time. And then the second was, I guess, Tiger winning for the first time. And then the next one was the Sharks collapse.
Yes.
Greg Norman folded up, and I'm going, this is the best event in the history of sports. It just never seems to disappoint, does it?
No, it doesn't. I mean, you look at it, and it was kind of incredible. My third Masters was Jack. you know, I mean,
wow.
It was like, I mean, it just tumbled one after another. Each one has a story. You've got, you know, Larry Mize chipping in. You've got Curtis Strange shooting 80 in the first round, and the entire press room is sitting there on Saturday night going, oh my gosh, is he going to do this? Is he going to come back from an 80 and win the Masters? There's so much rich everything there. I don't think you ever got the chance, Kirk, to walk with Snead and Sarrazin.
No.
That was amazing. I sat with Sarrazin actually the night before his final ceremonial nine with Snead. I sat with him up on the upstairs veranda and wrote a column about him. And I remember asking him why he was going to stop at that point. And he just kind of held his hands out and said, these hands just don't do it anymore. And so I walked the nine the next day. Right. And he hits this shot on, I think it was seven, that goes, just finds its way right through the trees. I have no idea how it happened, and it lands on the green. And you're like, you know, Snead is giving him the hardest time. At the end, he turns over to Snead, and he goes, hey, Sam, want to play nine more? Snead just goes, bleh, and walks off, you know. But
he didn't have another double eagle that day, did he?
No. But, you know, the beauty of the Masters, too, is to be able to – and I was blessed beyond belief to be able to cover – you know, people like Byron Nelson and Sarrazin and Snead and all those guys. And that's what the Masters is all about too, that rich history. And Ben is the guy right now who ties all that back. Ben right. and Jack, to me, they're the ones that are the gatekeepers, if you will, of that part of Augusta. And, you know, they're just as excited as we are on that first tee. They're like, oh, what's going to happen? You know, who's going to do this or that? You know, I mean, we both go over to Ben all the time. Hey, what do you think about so-and-so? How's he playing? You know? And it doesn't get a whole lot better than last year either. I mean, I was there with Tigers first. I was there. I had a great feeling about him from the Wednesday night on. He hopped out of his car at the dinner and comes bouncing up, and he's just so relaxed. And he's come to dinner every time we've honored him, which is like a dozen times. Mm-hmm. And you can see how relaxed and at peace he was with himself. And then watching that build, something's going to happen this week too. I wouldn't be surprised if it was Brooks Koepka actually. I it's just a feeling.
Well, wow. Brooks Koepka is going off at 17-1. That's a nice bet.
You know, there's a lot of great players that are playing well, but I kind of like that a little bit too. So anyway,
I wanted to ask y'all about this incredible Hulk guy, Bryson DeChambeau, who went into the weight room and came out looking like a tight end. He's the favorite right now to win it. They call it plus 750, which is basically seven and a half to one to win the Masters. Does this course, you know, you guys are the golf writers, does this course bunch up and suit his long ability? And they're talking about him using a 48-inch driver. And what does that mean in layman's terms, golf writers?
Means he's going to slam it down there and try to get it on the green. He's going to try to overpower a course that takes a lot of finesse. You've got to know an awful lot about that golf course. I've spent so much time with Ben. There are wind currents that you just know about after you play for a while. There's shots that you know. And I think with the wetness of the greens and the fairways, I don't know that that's going to be the best thing. I may be proven totally wrong, but I think Augusta is a course where it's going to be difficult for him because you're going to have the feel. You're going to have to know where to place it on the green. And certainly he is what everybody's talking about. And I think there are courses, obviously, that he can do that with. I'm not so sure that Augusta is one of them. You look at Tiger in his prime or Norman in his prime, they were long hitters. They didn't overpowered the golf course, but they put it down there a long way. somebody like Brooks hits it a long way, but he's not going for what DeChambeau's going for. What do you think, Doc?
Well, you know, it's 80% chance of rain today on Thursday, and it diminishes the rest of the weekend. But, the wet conditions, a lot of those, downhill fairways, like, number 10, for example, a lot of those golfers like to get that extra yardage on rolls, and DeChambeau doesn't need that. And I've been frankly surprised that he's got a little better feel and finesse than you would think just this brute of a golfer, just this overpowering type machine has. So I don't know. He sure doesn't lack for confidence, that for sure. So I wonder.
It's bordering on arrogance. I mean, he rubs me a little the wrong way. And, but a football player can talk to us like that, and we're like, oh, yeah, he's got swagger. But a golfer does it, and you're like, ease up, dog, ease up.
Right. Yeah, he and Brooks Koepka aren't my favorite golfers. Like you said, Mel, I like the finesse game. Ben Crenshaw was that kind of guy. You know, Zach Johnson, guys that keep it in the fairway and make precise shots. So are you picking Koepka, or who's your pick? Oh,
no, I never pick anybody until I see the first round, because the one thing about that, and it's no knock on DeChambeau. I think he does have some finesse, right? But I just think that you have to have a lot of finesse. You have to have a lot of local knowledge on that golf course, and which means you have to play it a lot. And I'm not sure he's played it a lot. But the thing that has always stood by me, that I've always stood by when I look at a Masters, is how they start, how they feel. Watch them. Watch their, watch the way they're walking, watch the way they're approaching. And you never know until they get off that first tee and they get at least 9 holes behind them.
Yeah.
Maybe more. And then you start to get a feel for who's feeling very comfortable within themselves. And, like a Fred Couples in 92, he was very comfortable in his own skin. Got lucky too at 12, but,
so did Tiger last year at 12.
Exactly. And you got to get lucky.
Out of the water.
Well, Ben, you think about the final round of 95, when he went in the azaleas on number 2, and that could have been lost, and he gets in there and he finds it and he gets it out. I mean,
you gotta be a little lucky. Like you said, on 12, Molinari and everybody went in the water. Everybody and his brother went in the water on 12, and Tiger just, puts it right there, on the green, and pars it, and the rest is history. He was on his way. So
Tiger goes, got this. I got this.
Yeah, exactly. What about Tiger? 40-1. Underdog to win this.
That's a good question, Sid. He seems very relaxed, and he talked at the Champions dinner and then the press conference Tuesday about, how sentimental and nostalgic he is, and remembers grabbing Charlie, after winning it. And I don't know. There's always, like Melanie said, there's always such a great muscle memory for the people like Fred Couples, like Ben, like Tiger, that keep coming back. And I wouldn't discount Tiger, although he's not playing his best. And he's missing too many, 10-foot putts and inside. So, I'll be surprised if he wins it, but I'm never surprised if he's going to play well and in the mix there. But his putting worries me a little bit. How do you feel, Mel?
Who else was not putting well going into?
Well, Jordan Spieth hadn't really done anything.
Well, no, I'm thinking Ben Crenshaw in 95.
A lot of ills.
I think Tiger wants number 6. I think he wants to tie Nicklaus. I think he really does want to do that. But this Tiger is more mature, and he knows that the only way that's going to come is by him doing the best he can with what he's got right now. He's not the kid that stopped. I mean, I will never forget standing on the lawn that Sunday morning in 97 when he walked – when he walked over to the putting green to take the first, couple of putts, and then he turned around and went back to the driving range. I mean, things just stopped. Everybody stopped. It was like everybody pressed pause and here's this guy walking through this crowd. Nobody's saying anything. Everybody understood the magnitude of what was going to happen that day. If he stood up and finished that tournament, that was huge. And I'll never forget that look on his face and watching him mature into last year's Tiger. I think you always look at those guys. You know, people discounted Nicklaus. I mean, you know, I'm out there walking. I was walking behind Nicklaus. I was walking with Ballesteros and Keit when they both eagled 8 that day. And Jack kind of turned around. He was way up on 9. He kind of turned around because he heard the back-to-back roars. And then it was like he just took off, put the pedal down, and said, "See ya." You know, and I think that experience, you never discount it. I'm not saying that he's playing well enough to win, but if things broke the right way, you just never know.
Yeah. You mentioned the roars, and that's one of the main things that we'll miss is that there's nothing like hearing the cascading roars come over those pine trees. It's truly one of the most spectacular sounds, you know, in all of sports.
And you know a Jack roar from a Tiger roar from a Brooks roar. You do.
You just tell.
Kid you not, Sid. You know the difference. You just do.
Well, before we get out of here, I need to ask you both. And Kirk, you just mentioned it. If there's one thing you're going to miss the most about not being there this year, what will it be, Mel?
Could I say
sitting next to the duck?
No.
sitting next to the duck? That's the plan.
No.
Hey, I haven't sat next to him in 6 months, and I don't miss that. So go ahead.
We also share a house. He's in the house. But, no, I'll miss being able to tell that story, whatever the story is. There's always a great story or two. I think that's what I'll miss, just being able to do that. And you can do it from TV, but –
It's not the same.
It's not the same. No.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. What about you, Kirk?
You know, you mentioned the big tree, you know, outside the clubhouse, and I love gathering there and, you know, visiting with, you know, some of the old greats in golf and like Ben Crenshaw and others, and just being around that first tee and the electricity that you have, and it starts building the day before at the par 3. Said it's the prettiest little 9-hole. Course in the entire world, and people are just packed, and you see somebody like a David Robinson caddying for Corey Pavin. You know, you get this monster guy in this white caddy suit, and just the visual and just bumping into people that may have been there the first time and interacting with those patrons, if you will. It's just the entire experience of that week. It's just phenomenal. It's a privilege to, you know, to be able to go there and to kind of chronicle it. And I know Melanie feels the same way.
It is. That tree holds a lot of memories. I mean, I remember one day Arnold shot like 80 and came off, and we're all standing there, you know, hoping to get him. And he kind of veers off over to the side where the umbrellas are, where everybody's eating, and he's standing there talking, and everybody's like, is he going to do it? And they looked at me, and I said, okay, I'll go ask him. And so I walked over and I said, hey, Arnold, there's a couple of us over there that would like to just get a couple minutes with you. Can we have a couple minutes before you have lunch? And he looked up and he said, sure. And walked over and talked about his 80.
I love that, man.
You know, but it was all under the tree. Things like magic things happen under the tree, you know.
You know, the thing you mentioned, Jack, when Greg Norman blew that, what was he, 6-stroke lead on Sunday, whatever it was, Nick Faldo chases him down. And remember, he was just blowing away the field that whole week. And I remember talking to Jack under that tree. We're all thinking, oh, well, we've written Norman every day. What are we going to write? And I remember talking to Jack under the tree, you know, late morning, you know, long before they tee off. And remember, Greg had won British Opens, but he hadn't won on this side of the ocean. So we said, is this going to validate Greg Norman's career, you know, winning a Masters to go with the British Opens? And he just kind of puts up a finger. He hadn't won yet. You know, and so he kind of said, well, we got a 20cc. And so anyway, about three of us riders were talking to him. We walk off and he goes, come on, Jack. And Jack knew, he knew the pressure that these golfers feel. There's nothing like pressure in sports like that back nine on Sunday.
Well, and Norman's your perfect guy there.
Yeah.
Because I can't tell you how many times I stood in front of his locker on Sunday night. Yeah. And he's like, what have I got to do? I love this golf course and it just doesn't love me back. And, you know, yeah, exactly. He never made it.
And
he was a stand-up guy. I remember he was such a classy in response, you know, after he lost that. So I'm also going to miss our meals on the veranda at the clubhouse at the
– I know.
It's just – I don't know. I'm going to tear up. Also –
But you know what, though?
What?
They're going to play it again in just a few months. I mean, you guys will get to go back. This is like an appetizer, and you'll look up, and we get through the spring, and everybody gets that shot in the butt, that vaccine. You guys will be back there doing what you do.
There you go. I sure hope so.
I'm picking Dustin Johnson to win, going out on a big limb there. Sid, who you got? You got anybody you want to pick?
I'm going with Brooks Koepka.
Okay.
I'm going with Brooksy. So we'll see. We'll see.
Dustin Johnson's back from the coronavirus and playing well. I know he played well in Houston.
Damn that corona.
Too bad Sergio got tested positive.
That's rough, man.
He was so excited about that. Well, before we let you go to Jordan Spieth, I mean, hadn't won in 3 years since the British.
Yeah.
What do you think for him in the future?
I think he'll be back. I haven't really talked to him, but so many guys, you see them, you know, jet out and just really have, you know, these breakout year or two, and then things happen. You know, he gets married, this happens, that happens, and you change something, and it's a little dip. I mean, one of the reasons that I like Koepka, although I do reserve judgment until after the first round is over, is, you know, he's got eight top sixes.
That's very difficult to do.
And what, three or four wins since 2017? Mm-hmm. That's an experience level that is huge. And, you know, DJ played very well down in Houston as well and knows that course, knows Augusta well.
Right. He was a quiet second to Tiger last year.
Exactly. And, you know, I mean, who'd have thought that golf would have taken me to all these different things and have all these memories? Kirk, we need to write a book about Underneath the Tree, something like that.
I like it. And the guy I'd really love to win is Rory McIlroy.
Absolutely.
He's meant to complete the Grand Slam, and that would be good. I think he will win it one day. I really do. But
13-1 this year, 13-1.
Yeah. I'd love to see that as well. He's just a class guy, and you know, a quiet guy who could win again is a guy like Adam Scott.
Yeah.
He's playing very well. I mean, the one thing when you go to the Masters is you better not just have one person on your radar. You better have at least half a dozen.
Nice.
That you're looking at and that you're paying attention to. Because as a writer and as a columnist, which is what I've basically been for the last however many Masters, at least half of them I've been basically a columnist. You look for that. You look for getting into that. And you, I don't care about the numbers. Don't tell me that the fourth ranked player in the world has won, you know, five times there. I could care less about those kind of numbers. I'm looking at the person. I'm looking at how they're handling themselves. Are they comfortable with themselves and their game? And just everything else that goes with it. And when you've been around these guys for a long time, you can see it. You can feel it, you know.
So you are riding off this. You're riding this weekend, right, Mel?
Actually, I don't know exactly what I am writing. I know that I'm writing about the U.S. Women's Open this week.
Where can we find your stuff?
It'll be in the Chronicle, actually.
The Chronicle.
I write once a week in the Chronicle. I do everything from rehashing the Earl Campbell miracle for four touchdowns and 199 yards on Monday Night Football, which I covered for the Austin American States.
Against my Dolphins. Against my Dolphins. And he blows by his buddy, Steve Toll, who was a really good linebacker.
Exactly.
And Earl Campbell takes it to the house, and my dad's going, I told you that boy would be good. I go, you always thought he was fat.
You know, I get to dig down into great stories like that, you know.
You hit a nerve with Cedric there.
You know.
No one even knows who Steve Toll is. Come on.
I know who Steve Toll is. I was actually – David Cass Stevens and I were behind Earl that night. They flashed past us on the deal, but you know, we're down there trying to we're being duck. We're trying to get every emotion that we can from the sideline, you know. So it'll be there. I don't know exactly what I'll write next week. I'm sure it will be something. It just varies for me week to week.
Duck, are you writing every day? We haven't talked about this.
No, probably not every day because our deadlines are so darn early. But, I know Scotty Scheffler, our UTX, tees off early this morning.
You know what? There's a guy who's going to win soon. He's going to win a major soon. He is a good player.
I think so. Yep.
You know, he would be one of the people that I would watch this week. I mean, I would watch him in the opening round and see how he handles things.
Well, he was in the PGA Championship in the final round with Dustin Johnson.
He's right there.
Pressure doesn't get to him. He's got a really, really good overall game.
I guarantee you he's picked Ben's brain.
Oh, yeah.
I guarantee you. Yeah.
He's crazy if he hasn't.
Yeah. Absolutely. No, absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, it's been a pleasure having you on. And said she makes a mean chocolate chip cookie, too.
Stay away from my friend, Mel. I'm trying to keep him on this side of the dirt.
Thanks, guys. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Mel. Thanks, so good Mel. To talk to you.
Have a good one.
On Second Thought.
Duck, great conversations with Melanie Hauser. Man, it just feels like an alumni day at the Statesman. I mean, we go from Melanie Hauser to our guy Olin Buchanan of TexAggs.com. The Aggies were going to play at Tennessee Saturday, but that Rona got them. And so one of four SEC games postponed. And OB, are we going to be able to get a rein on the SEC and get this thing back on tracks before it's just totally out of control?
Well, first of all, I'm honored that y'all still claim me. We do.
I don't know about other folks, but I know we do.
I have no doubt in my mind. We don't want to acknowledge that guy. Why not? You've seen across the country, you know, teams lose games and then they have to take a break. I called it today in a column. I said it's like I don't know if you're old enough to remember this, Cedric. I know Kirk is well old enough to remember. it's like the 8-track tape. You know, you're grooving. You got a good song.
And all the 8-track.
The song has to switch to the next track. So you know, it's kind of annoying. But then you pick up the groove again, you know. So I think that's what's going on. You're going to have a week, maybe two, probably 2 week break, and then pick back up. If Wisconsin's playing after a couple of weeks,
exactly. How are they playing?
So I don't think anybody is surprised by this, but it's when you see four games in a single conference get postponed and we're running out of dates in the back end. And Olin, I don't know how you and Cedric feel, but to me, I just wish the folks in control said, you know what, we're going to push this playoff back. And why do we have to finish by January 11th? Because everybody's adapting to this. We had the NBA finals in what? October. I don't know how far they went. We've got the Masters going on this week in November. I wish they'd expand the playoffs to 8, and I wish we'd play it in February.
Well, first of all, I wish they'd expand the playoffs to 8 anyway.
Yeah. Yes.
But, why not? Why not push back? The only thing I can figure is because of the semester break and guys, people typically going home and whatnot, but you keep them around when they're playing for championships. And if it's, right. But that said, now the SEC, at least they had some foresight that I guess Big Ten didn't have, and that they scheduled things so they'd have an open date.
Exactly.
So A&M is now scheduled to go out to Knoxville on December 12th. And let me tell you, I'm really looking forward to going to Northeast Tennessee in mid-December.
But you love Knoxville. You do love Knoxville.
I like Nashville.
Oh, that's different.
Yeah, that's different. It's pretty. It's pretty in spots. But anyway, I digress. And then you know what? They've even said that that they're considering letting teams play on the championship week.
Right.
So they're obviously working to do whatever they can to get as many games in as they can. And I wouldn't be completely surprised if it comes to that, if they take Kirk's advice, which typically is not wise to do.
Not good.
But in this instance, I would not be surprised if they took Kirk's advice and did move things back.
But you know, yeah, because 2020 is an outlier, man. Yeah. And it's a just yeah. this everything should be on the table in 2020.
Everything.
Because if it could go wrong in 2020, it's gonna go wrong. Absolutely. And for the Big Ten and the Pac-12 to not build in bye weeks, what have you been watching in this country? It's just nuts.
Yeah. Let me ask you guys something. Don't you think it's that you're really concerned about? You wonder about what the Big Ten was thinking, and do you really even care about the Pac-12?
No, because they don't have any real spine or backbone. They sit there and wait, and then when the Big Ten finally decides, okay, I see what's going on down south, and they're having fun, they're playing football, and then the Pac-12, okay, I guess we'll play.
But don't you even sometimes even forget the Pac-12 even exists?
This is a really bad era for the Pac-12.
Yeah, if I wasn't an AP voter, I might agree with that only because I always have to stay up and watch Pac-12 after dark. But you're right. And this year has shown all the flaws and frailties of college football, how dysfunctional it is. Nobody's in charge. I think we need a commissioner or, you know, expand the selection committee, make it a commission that runs college football. So we're not having one conference play, other one's not. And okay, well, we might play. It's just so bizarre. And it makes it, to me, it makes the sport look very bad. That it's like every man for himself. And I hate that look. I think it's a bad optics.
You know, it is like every man for himself. And quite frankly, if you had a commissioner and the things you're describing, you know, you might have, like you just said, a commission for a playoff, you know, committee instead of just a smaller committee. You might have officiating full-time officials, or at least, you know, more uniformed right. officiating. You might not have any programs like having their own network. It's amazing what could happen.
Is that possible? Well, the college football should join the new century. And we did notice your dig there. So
I think college football.
You come on here hating on the LHN, OB. You come on here hating on the LHN.
I don't hate
I've
it.
Got 15 million reasons why they like the
LHN. I enjoy the history.
That's the history channel. Yeah,
I enjoy it. You know, college football is still fine. It's still great. It's still doing it. But can it be better?
It could be better.
Be the best you can be.
It could be better. Well,
you know. But you know what? The thing that bothers me about it is all of this money is rolling in. And this is not just about college football. This is the NCAA. And when we're talking about the NCAA and big checks rolling in, we're talking about basketball and football. And so they just don't seem to be – they just don't want to be a governing body. They just want to be this big monolithic entity. As long as the money's rolling in and the trains are running on time, they always want to just leave it up to the conferences. And when you got so many conferences, it's going to be a cluster F moment when something major like 2020 happens.
Well, you know what I think is that I think two things should happen. Number one, they should go, like Kirk suggested, get a commissioner. But I also believe – that the Power Five conference, the major players, the guys at the $100 table should break off. And then you would have a commissioner overlooking maybe five conferences and change, because we're really still asking Texas and Texas A&M and Oklahoma and Alabama to a certain degree to play by the under the same restrictions and guidelines that, you know, South Alabama and Houston and Utah State have. And that just doesn't make sense to me. And the way, the fact that they have not yet broken away, I find is a little bit surprising.
I love that $100 table analogy, because they are the big dogs, and they're playing with much bigger chips, and there's much more at stake at the end of the year, because that CFP money is major money. And we know that those schools like the ones you mentioned are going to be in that mix. So do y'all think that it'll ever come to the Power Five splitting off and being its own league or its own organization? How far are we from that, Doug?
It's going to take some powerful, well-meaning people in charge of these Power Five conferences to have a soul and do what's best for the game and not just themselves. It's all about control. It's all about money. The Power Five conferences make all the money and they don't want to share it, okay? It's not for the good of the game. It's for the good of the Power Five. And that's why the Big Ten, especially SEC, you know, they're paying schools more than $50 million every year to each school, you know, and you maybe have a Boise State getting $3 million a year. So there's never been any equity and it's not a level playing field. We all know that. So it's so far down the line. And maybe, like, the pandemic could lead to this, guys, because, you know, who knows what college basketball's future, what's going to happen. The NCAA lost that paycheck last spring. And if they lose it again, who's to say the NCAA just doesn't go under? And then maybe all bets are off. And we just have to look at a new way of doing things in college athletics.
Well, I think it might have gotten closer than you think just a few years ago when the Power Five conferences said they wanted an autonomy and they wanted to be able to pay players a stipend, right? Right. They wanted to do some other things. And, you know, for years, it's the smaller schools that's no, because we can't afford that. We don't want to do it. And then they finally said, well, we're going to do it. And then you saw the smaller schools start to fall in line. Okay, why? Because I think the threat was, this is what we're going to do. We're going to start paying these guys some more. We're going to do this. And if you have a problem with it, we'll just break off. Yeah. And I think – so I think then it was closer to happening than you might think.
Yeah, it's just kind of around the edges. You know, you're exactly right. These other schools want a piece of the pie, whatever they can get. They don't want the crumbs. Group of Five AAC wants to be one of the Power Five and thinks there should be a Power Six. But it's like the gap gets so wide. I'm sorry?
I think I should be a millionaire.
Or the commissioner.
I thought you were. I thought you were a millionaire.
Doesn't Texas?
What happened to your chips, OB?
I was at the $100 tables.
Not very long, though, right?
We've been at some tables together, but we were never at a $100 table, dog. Never been at a $100 table. I can tell you that.
I think we've solved college football's issues now. Let's move on to this year. Are the Aggies all that? I wrote this week that they're a legitimate CFP contender, that I put out a scenario where they can realistically get in the Final Four. OB, are you on board?
Well, yeah, I am. I think now their hopes are, of course, dependent on them going 9-1.
Sure.
Of course.
And it looks good. It looks promising.
Yeah.
If they get them all played. Right. I don't think there's a game left on their schedule that they would not be favored in, and they're playing very well right now. But at the same time, and I'll continue to say this, they're not as good as they're playing. They're not good enough to overlook anybody. And if they come out a little bit flat, they could lose any game that's still on their schedule. So it's dependent on them going 9-1, and their hopes did take a hit with Notre Dame upsetting Clemson.
That wasn't good. No,
because if they have a rematch in the ACC championship game and Clemson wins, well, you know, then you have two one-loss teams, and both of their losses were to each other. As it stands now, A&M has one of the best victories in the country, and that would be over Florida, which is, I think, ranked number 6. So very few teams – you know, if you get a Clemson with a second loss, or say Notre Dame has a hangover and loses to Boston College this weekend, which I wouldn't pick, but I would not say it's out of the realm of possibility. If that happened and then they lost, if you get some two-loss teams out of the way – You're actually rooting for Florida and Alabama right now, believe it or not. And then you're hoping Alabama beats Florida. Florida would get its second loss.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So if you can clean up some of those things while you go 9-1, then at the end of the year, if you're Texas A&M sitting there at 9-1 and the other teams you're looking at are Cincinnati and BYU, and let's say they're unbeaten, it comes down to saying, hey, do you think Cincinnati and BYU would beat Florida? And
if your answer is
no, then you say, why are we having this discussion?
Well, they might. You don't know that.
Cincinnati, well, here's the thing. Let me ask. I've seen BYU.
I saw, you know what?
They're okay. Look,
I know.
But I've seen the Aggies, and they're better.
I've seen
BYU. Oh, yeah, clearly better than them.
In 2009, okay, things changed. But in 2009, you might remember Cincinnati was third in the nation. Third, and they were upset that they didn't get to play for the national championship. It was Alabama and Texas. But they were third in the nation, so they got sent to the Sugar Bowl to play Florida.
That was hideous.
51-24.
That was hideous.
Wait. What does that mean? Didn't Boise State play Oklahoma once?
Was Oklahoma playing a national championship contender?
It was a Fiesta Bowl game.
Yeah, I know.
It was a major game, and Boise arrived, and they've arrived ever since, and nobody's doubted them.
Yeah, and you know what? And since you brought up BYU, you know, that Boise is BYU's best win right now.
Mm-hmm.
Boise didn't have their starting quarterback.
Good is good, though. I should always say, if you put the Green Bay Packers against Ole Miss – they're going to beat them 60-0 after one quarter.
I don't understand that.
You're going to say, well, Green Bay Packers aren't any good. Who do they play?
Where are you going with that?
Good is good. If you watch Cincinnati or BYU, you can't tell me those aren't credibly good.
I can say they're good teams, but are they better than Florida? And I would say no.
I'd say they have a chance. Florida's defense is horrible.
Of the two, Cincinnati's
defense is not horrible.
BYU's got a great quarterback. I like the quarterback.
He's great. He's great.
Cincinnati's defense really got after SMU. I watched that one.
Defense.
But when I see Florida or A&M or somebody like that, I don't hesitate that they're probably gonna beat those two teams by double digits. Because A&M is built. Kellen Mond has been better. I mean, he's colored in between the numbers, and he hasn't been all over the place. He's playing like a senior. When I went to cover A&M against Vandy, I think that was the opener, OB, they won 17-12. Mm-hmm. And I kept going, why isn't Isaiah Spiller in the game? That Sanias kid was getting a lot of carries. Somewhere along the line, Isaiah Spiller was Isaiah Spiller, and
I think Jimbo's fine.
And Jimbo, ever since, Jimbo's out, well, this is our guy. So I think one thing I want to ask you, OB, they've got some injuries. You're gonna get healed up. You think they might miss a couple of weeks here, but there's something to be said for the momentum that they have built. They have been on a freaking roll.
Oh, no, you know, we're making gambling analogies earlier. Here we go again. If I'm at the table and I've won 7 or 8 hands in a row, I'm not going to get up and go to the bathroom, right? If I'm hot, I want to keep playing. Well, A&M has a break, you know. Do you want it? Absolutely not. You want to go into Tennessee, number one, while you're playing well, and number two, while they're not.
Exactly. They were horrible last week.
Yeah, and – You know, are they going to get better? Probably not. But, you know, you don't want to interrupt something when you, when you've got something, a good thing going. But that said, it's out of your hands now. Look at, try to look at the bright side. Isaiah Spiller looks like he's got a sore ankle. You're going to have some time to get that healed up. I think Jared Hocker had to leave the game. Now, his replacement at right guard, Layton Robbins, came in and played really well. But, you know, you get a time to get him healed up. So, yeah, if you have some bumps and bruises, or even if you have some guys, I know you can't practice the way you would, but if you have some guys, some young guys like a Damon Demas or Moose Muhammad Jr. that you think could come in and really help you at some time, you know, maybe it's just a little more time to try to bring them along, even if it's only on a Zoom call saying, do you understand what you do on this play or this, you know, all those things. So that's the bright side of it, or that's looking for the silver lining, I guess. But without a doubt, you wish you were playing because you're playing well.
You know, I like the path the Aggies are on, and you were talking about the ACC. I think Notre Dame could stumble before maybe they get to a rematch, and then if Notre Dame beats Clemson twice, Clemson will be out of the mix with two losses. No two-loss team has ever been in the playoffs. So,
and that helps A&M.
It helps A&M immensely, so I like their chances. One question I'd like to ask you, OB, is Jimbo Fisher, fast-talking Texan in history of our state.
Oh, my God.
What do you see from him that makes you think, well, this guy's an elite quarterback? Obviously, he's won a national championship, but size up Jimbo Fisher for us.
But first of all, you know, he's a football coach, and he's not trying to be anything else. And, you know, you always look for a fit. You know, Howard Snellenberger was a great fit at Miami and really at Louisville, but he was a terrible fit at Oklahoma, right? That doesn't mean he was a bad football coach. He just wasn't the right fit.
Charlie Strong.
Sometimes you're just not – well, I think Jimbo's a fit here. Mm-hmm. You know, he fits the culture here. People are kind of laid back. He likes to ride horses and hunt and fish, and well, that fits right in here, you know. So, you know, just a laid-back guy. And I think Jimbo's idea of fun is breaking down football tape.
Uh-oh.
Or video, you know, whatever you want to say. I think that's just what he does. I've heard, you know, he's recently married, and I heard he and his wife spend their evenings, I've been told. She'll watch the video, the football breakdown with him. You know, that's what I've been told. I mean, he's just a football coach. He's not trying to be anything else.
He's a junkie. He's a football junkie. Yeah.
And he's obviously very successful. Was successful as a coordinator at Auburn and LSU. Has been successful as a head coach at Florida State. And he's – there's really no reason to think he wouldn't be successful here. And he's recruited extremely well. And I think – I never understood the national media that was kind of taking every kind of shot at him that they could, you know, because of his salary. Like nobody else in college football makes a lot of money. But, you know, in the first couple of years, and I'd say, man, I remember, you know, Mac Brown, I think went, 1-22 or 2-22 in his first 2 years at North Carolina and turned them into a strong program.
Yes.
Sometimes you got to get your recruits in and start building something. And when you look at A&M, and I think this is one of the reasons they're playing so well right now. When you look at A&M, yeah, you got a senior quarterback and you have a senior dominated offensive line, but you see an awful lot of sophomores that are in that starting lineup. And a lot of them played or started as freshmen. And so when the players typically really start picking up steam and gaining traction, I'd say it's usually midway through their second year. And so I think that's one of the things. So you look at sophomore Jalen Widemeyer, sophomore Nia Smith, sophomore Kenyon Green, sophomore Isaiah Spiller. You had sophomore or second year redshirt freshman Caleb Chapman before he got hurt, but a second year player in Chase Lane as one of your better receivers, and then look at the defense with the Marvin Leal and Damani Richardson. And so you're seeing a lot of second-year players that Jimbo Fisher brought in and has developed starting to really hit the stride.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Recruiting's going so well, and they've got great speed. I wonder a little bit about quarterback after Kellen Mond. I don't know if you'd just take a second to evaluate the future after Kellen.
Well, they seem to like this freshman out of Longview, Haynes King. They seem to like him a lot.
Coach's son.
Yeah, and he came in mop-up time against Alabama and actually ran the ball really effectively. Had an interception on a throw to the corner. I thought his receiver could have, like, worked a little bit harder to at least try to break it up. Okay, I'll just leave it at that. And he threw a touchdown pass mop-up duty against South Carolina. But it's a small sample size. He's looked fine. I know that they've raved about him and how smart he is. And what a good athlete he is. I think he's one of the fastest guys on the team. So I heard he's one of the fastest guys at Longview. If you know anything about East Texas, that means you're one of the fastest guys on the team now.
He's one of the fastest guys at Longview. He's pretty dang fast.
Yeah. So they feel really good about him. Then there's Zach Calzada, who was the backup last year. He was out of Georgia and probably has the strongest arm of anybody on campus. So I think, and then they got a kid coming in that they've got a commitment from out of Denton named Eli Stowers that they're really excited about. So I think they have guys that they feel good about, and that's going to be a process of developing. How fast are they going to develop? We'll see. I thought Kellen Mond was pretty good 2 years ago in his first year under Jimbo Fisher. Wasn't as good last year, but of course he didn't have an All-American tight end. He didn't have the SEC leading rusher behind him, and he had an offensive line that was beat up. So maybe that had something to do with it. But I think that they feel like they're in a pretty good spot at quarterback. If he wants to, the NCAA has given Kellen Mond the option to come back next season.
Yeah, we always hear about that.
Yeah, I don't think that'll
happen. You know what? If I'm going to get beat up playing football, I'm going to be doing it at somebody's training camp.
Well, I understand that. I would, too. Of course, then there's going to be the argument say, yeah, but next year the draft won't have Fields and Lawrence and the guy from North Dakota State and Kyle Trask, and maybe you get drafted like – have a chance to be in the first round. But, no, I'm not suggesting that he's going to come back. I'm suggesting that the guys they have, who knows what they are, but they at least feel good about them right now.
Yeah, no, you're right. I think one of the things that I feel is incredibly good about Aggies right now is their O-line and D-line. And Olin, you know how important controlling the line of scrimmage is in the SEC.
Yeah. Anywhere, sir. Anywhere.
But especially that league where they have so many great D linemen. And it just seemed like maybe Jimbo's following that model, and they're really strong in both those areas.
You know, there's just so much physically bigger than they used to be.
Mm-hmm. That I noticed.
Like I know Bobby Brown. I always say if Bobby Brown's wearing a white T-shirt, you can watch a movie on his back. Jaden Peavy, and then you get a guy like DeMarvin Leal come in, who's not as wide as they are, but tall, big, good-looking athlete, and it really run. The two freshmen tackles that they brought in this year, McKinley Jackson, Isaiah Rakes, just really big guys. So I can remember back in my previous job when Charlie Strong, I was doing a story on him when he was the defensive coordinator at Florida, and they came to play Vanderbilt, so I went up to see that butt kicking, and went down to talk to Charlie after the game, and looking at close up at the lineman at Florida, and it was just so much different, just the size and the mass of those guys. And I think what you're seeing at A&M is Jimbo Russ. I mean, that's the kind of guy you got to have if you're gonna. They always call the SEC a line of scrimmage league, okay?
It is.
Except for not, that's the kind of guys you're going to have to compete in that line of scrimmage league, and I think he's doing a good job of finding, bringing in, and developing guys that fit and that can match up.
So do you think A&M will win a national championship in the next – this year, next year, the year after?
Yeah, I, you know, I'll put it this way. I think A&M can be a national championship contender, not this year, but in the years moving forward. I do think they'll be a contender. Now, we all know that crazy things can happen. So to say they're going to win a national championship, there are talking, since I'm talking to you guys, there are people I've heard that would say the best team in the country in 2008 was Texas. They didn't get to play for the national championship.
They didn't get to play for the Big 12 championship.
Yeah, and we've seen Auburn back in the day be undefeated and didn't get a chance to play. Right. The Oklahoma State's going to play for a national championship in what, 2010, and their kicker misses a chip shot field goal, and they lose to Iowa State. So to say, yeah, they're going to win a national championship 4 or 5 years, to me, you know, that's like, you know, it's if you say that they are, you're just asking to be wrong.
How about playing in a championship game?
But if you're saying, are they a contender?
Yes.
Then I'm going to say that they're going to be a strong contender. They're going to be in that conversation. And, you know, are you going to have to get by Alabama?
Yeah.
You know, and I can understand how this might come off, but I think if they were in a different conference.
Easy Tiger.
Opportunities. But you know what? At the same time, if they were in a different conference, they may not be getting the kind of player they're getting now. Because one of the things they sell is that, hey, come play at A&M. You're going to play in the best conference in America.
Right. At some point, you got to say, you're not just going to play in the best conference. You're going to have a chance to win that conference.
And you know what?
Where I think they are.
And, I mean, this year, you can make a very strong argument. In fact, I don't know how you could argue against it, that they are the second best team in the SEC.
They are.
Kirk wrote that, yeah.
They clearly are.
How do you say, unless you're Kirk Herbstreit, how do you say they're not? I mean, don't we have to judge it based on what happened on the field?
Thank you.
They beat Florida on the field.
I don't look at the jerseys anymore. I look at the scoreboard, and they're damn good. And people might not like it, but it's just something you got to come to grips with. They are a physical bunch. They don't have to win. They don't have to ride Kellen Mond's arm at all times.
Right.
They get stops when needed, and they can control the line of scrimmage on both sides. That's how you win football games.
I would put it to you, like all right, as a guy who covers A&M, and again, I'm saying if they're playing their best ball, because they can't take anything for granted, I would say that, you know, I would take Ohio State over A&M. I would take Alabama over A&M.
Right.
But you take Ohio State and Alabama out of the mix, and I'm including Clemson in this, and Notre Dame. If you take Ohio State and Alabama out of the mix, what team in the country would you look at if they were playing A&M and both teams were playing at a high level? What did you would say, yeah, A&M can't win that game?
Cincinnati. Just kidding.
I would take a full strength Clemson over.
You know what, OB? I really hope we get the answer to that question. I really hope that they make it to the CFP and face one of those big dogs, because frankly, they've played well enough to get there. And if they play like they've been playing, and the Aggies going on the road and working people, I mean, remember when they would go to Ole Miss or Mississippi State and squeak out one or lose? They're working the mark of a great team is when you work teams you're supposed to work. And they killed South Carolina. I mean, that was a bludgeoning.
And they
didn't always do that.
No. Okay, Kirk, let me clarify. I'm not saying that A&M would beat Clemson. I'm saying that if both teams are playing well, I don't think you could just go and assume that A&M's going to lose.
Not with that Clemson defense. Oh, my God.
That's all I'm saying. Other than Alabama and Ohio State, I don't know that if both teams are playing at a high level, that there's a team that you just assume that A&M can't beat. That's all I'm saying.
No, I would just say, well, Clemson without three defensive starters, James Skalski, their linebackers, the heart and soul of the team. And they had a freshman quarterback in his second start.
And so, nobody brings that up when they say, hey, look at Notre Dame, how great Notre Dame is.
Yeah, right? And they should bring it up. And the other thing I would say, the one thing that's hurting A&M, and I disagree with this, is perception. And it goes to what have you done lately? And I mean, last 10, 20 years, Florida beats Georgia, a good Georgia team, not a great Georgia team, a good Georgia team that struggles on offense, especially at quarterback.
You're missing
Everybody goes crazy. Oh my God, the Gators are back. Contrast, damn good quarterback. But
isn't it funny how when you say, you just said it, when someone beats Georgia, they always say, oh, they're back. Go ahead.
I don't know who you're talking
about. Because I'm asking, like, where did they go? I mean.
Georgia's not as.
But it's head-to-head. Head-to-head matters. A&M beat Florida. A&M is better than Florida. You know, maybe if they played again, maybe Florida would win.
You know,
I always hate that Florida gets extra credit for beating a name brand in Georgia.
Those are your national writer friends that sometimes push that narrative.
They shape perception, and I think it's wrong.
And A&M doesn't have national guys blowing their horn.
You got to be objective about it.
I believe the national media is actually anti-Texas A&M. And I think it's because of when the story surfaced that A&M was pursuing Jimbo Fisher, the original reaction was, this is ridiculous. He's never going to leave Florida State. And then he did. So then you got to where you looked bad. Secondly, a lot of the national media loved Kevin Sumlin because he was one of those coaches that'll always be approachable, always be available for the national media, but he didn't. But he found the local media to be a bothersome.
That's really an interesting concept, OB. We've never had those problems in Austin. But go ahead.
So you have a national media that got proven wrong, and then liked the previous guy a lot, and now are also at every opportunity bringing up the fact that Fisher makes a ton of money. Even though one guy just a couple of weeks ago wrote how much money Fisher makes per win. But he didn't bring up the fact that, say, Jim Harbaugh makes even more per win.
Wins are hard to come. Boy, those are some expensive wins up in Ann Arbor right now.
Yeah, and I even pointed out that, like, the guy at Purdue makes $1 million a win. You know, so college football coaches make a lot of money. Newsflash.
Why do you think they hate A&M, Olin?
Huh?
Why do you think they hate old A&M?
Well, I think, you know, here's what I think, and this is from my years of living in Austin and when we're working and arguing with you every day. I think there is a caste system in college football, really college sports, but college football we're talking about. And I think there's this caste system. And if Texas wants to offer $10 million to Nick Saban for, you know, a national championship quarterback, people go, oh my gosh, $10 million. Wow. Texas really wants him. If A&M offers 7.5 a season to Jimbo Fisher, who won a national championship, everybody's like, what are the Aggies trying to do? Who do they think they are? So I think there's this caste system that certain programs can do one thing and it's acceptable. Other programs will do something similar and it is, it's unacceptable. And it, you know, it's strange because, you know, there was a time, like, you know, A&M's not supposed to have aspirations to break into the elite. You know, you're supposed to accept who the national media and the establishment say you are. But there was a time when Miami was a terrible program. They made the moves they had to make to become a great – Oregon was a terrible program. Is anybody mad that Phil Knight came in and pumped millions upon millions of dollars in the Oregon program and Oregon became – a powerful program or as powerful as you can be in the Pac-12.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody seems to have an issue with that, do they? Clemson, you know, Clemson pays their coach $10 million a year. You know, Clemson was once a perennial. Yeah. They had one crazy year in 81 where they won a national
board,
but they were perennial about an 8-win team.
Average.
And they pumped, not only by putting money into their coach, but they pumped so much money into their program.
No, here's my thing on that, guys. And OB, you listen to me on the radio and College Station, and I always say, if you get the guy you want and you pay whatever you want to get him, and I believe in my heart that when the Aggies decided that 7-5, 8-4 wasn't good enough, and they could have kept Sumlin around and they would have been going to the Blue Bonnet Bowl, whatever, all those second-tier bowl games. They would have continued to go to bowl games, but they were never going to be a player in the SEC with Sumlin as the head coach. Well, and so when they decided to break bread and get a national championship coach who has coached Heisman Trophy winner, that let me know that the Aggies were about business, that they want to win. There's one thing to want to compete, but it's quite another thing to want to win.
Well, I always said that A&M was the guy that was wanted to play at the $100 table, and he brought one $100 bill. Now they're bringing an entire wad of cash.
Let's go rewrite history. Do you remember the name Jackie Sherrill?
Yes, but okay. Here's what they would do that for their coach, but they never would pay the assistant coach, and they wouldn't put money into their facilities, which is one of the reasons that when RC was here at the end of his tenure, that he couldn't compete in recruiting because Texas, LSU, and Oklahoma had put so much into their facilities. RC couldn't keep his assistant coaches because they weren't paying them enough. Now, not only are they paying their head coach, they're paying their assistants, and as we all know, they've really pumped money into their facilities. And one last thing on the whole Jimbo thing, I'll ask you. Remember, the word was that Jimbo was going to be going to LSU when they fired Les Miles. It just didn't work out, right? Had LSU paid Jimbo Fisher to $7.5 million to replace Les Miles, had it been LSU, what do you think? Do you think there would have been the same negative reaction that there has been at A&M National?
No, because the national guys love to write about the traditional powerhouses. Yes. That the exorbitant salary would not have been a storyline at all.
I mean, you definitely mentioned it.
But no, but it wouldn't have been the focus of the story. I mean, he's going to be making 7.5 a year, blah, 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 blah. And that would have been it. It wouldn't have been like, what's LSU doing?
Well, that's why
it never would have happened.
That's why I mentioned several minutes ago, perception. Yeah. A&M is fighting perception. You know, it's like, and they need to be in that mix for, you know, not just 1 year, but 2 years and 3 years. And to me, they're Aggies should feel as good about themselves and their program right now as they ever have, especially since, you know, the Jackie Sherrill years late. And the R.C. Slocum years when he couldn't quite get over the hump. But they are going to fight that perception until they get over that hump. And Olin, you make great comments like Oregon and Clemson and the Boise States, how people have changed their image. And I really think A&M is in the process of doing that.
Kirk, when did – you would remember this because I can't. But in your opinion, when did Texas begin to really get that – traction under Mack Brown and go on a long run of success?
He finally beat Oklahoma. Remember, he lost five games in a row.
But even then, they were still
– they had the talent. Good. But it was the same as North Carolina when Mack couldn't get past Florida State. And he was winning. They would win 10 games every year, but you know, they weren't winning the Big 12. And then finally they were able to beat Oklahoma. And it was – you look back at the 2004-05 when they went to the Rose Bowl twice – beat Michigan and then beat Southern Cal, and then they just took off.
And if Mack and Greg Davis hadn't have been so conservative in 04 against OU,
right?
Maybe Texas wins two championships.
Instead, you're right. It's like their whole thing was no turnovers, no turnovers, no turnovers. But you don't play to your strength. Roy Williams never caught a touchdown pass against Oklahoma.
They put a gazelle. They put a gazelle, Vince Young, in a phone booth.
Yes.
And I just remember Tommy Harris. I remember Tommy Harris going,
"Yeah,
man, I'm just glad they didn't turn him loose. We would have been in trouble."
Yeah, let your athletes be athletes.
And the point I'm making is I think A&M is entering that point of where Texas was when it finally clicked, and they might not have beaten Oklahoma, but they became a team that was going to that was going to be a 10-win team and in the discussion for championships. Hey, this is going to be a contender. And I think that's what A&M's entering right now. Now, are they going to be able to beat Alabama? Or are they going to continue to lose to Alabama the same way Texas had trouble beating OU? Probably. But they're going to be in a position where they're going to be – I think you're going to have to look at them and say they're a serious challenger, which they haven't been. No one thought they were a challenger in 2012. That was a surprise. They were expected to be a challenger in 2013, and you might recall that was a tremendous game against Alabama. In 2013 here, 49-42, Alabama won. But I think what you're going to see is you're going to see A&M becoming that team, maybe even what replace Auburn in the caste system of the the SEC West. Yeah.
That's interesting. That's interesting. Yeah.
Well, when Johnny Manziel was there, A&M made some noise, made some national noise, and now they got the whole band. You know, you got the O line, you got the D line, you got speed, you got skilled people.
You got the coach.
You got the coach. You got the SEC money. It's all converging perfectly for A&M right now. And frankly, if I'm Texas, I'm really scared because they're not matching that.
I haven't noticed anybody calling for a game against A&M for a while.
I am. I want to see him play.
Hey, you know, I'm talking about –
I'll go tomorrow. I'd go cover that without a mask. I'd go to that one.
I'm just messing with you. But you know what? Since I brought that up, I grew up with that game, and I've always been a proponent of it.
Yes.
But I've changed my opinion on it.
Hold on here. I know what you're going to say.
Okay? No, I'm not trying to be a wise guy.
No. Well, we got bigger fish to fry in College Station now. We don't need that.
It's not even that. A&M is going to play just like everybody else in the SEC West. They're going to play one Power 5 program a year, just like everybody else does. So they're going to play their SEC West opponents. They're going to play two from the East and one Power 5 opponent. That's what they're going to do. And next year it's going to be Colorado. But after that, it's going to be 2 years against Miami and then 2 years against Notre Dame. And I just – as you try to become a national brand and you look at A&M, they're recruiting nationally, then I think to become a national brand at A&M, it behooves you to schedule national games. And not regional ones.
Why not play two? Why not play two tough?
I just said that they're going to do what every other team in the SEC West does. Mm-hmm. Every other team in the SEC West plays their SEC West schedule. You're always going to play LSU. You're always going to play Alabama. You're always going to play Auburn. They're going to, and you're always going to get.
Why three cupcakes?
Huh?
Why three cupcakes?
Wow.
You're going to
play nine games.
Everybody, that's what everybody in the West does. Why should A&M be expected to be any different than the competition that they're facing?
Well, here's why. We've been talking for 30 minutes about changing their image, changing their perception, not being afraid of anybody. So you can play tougher teams.
They just played Clemson. They're playing Notre Dame, and you're saying they need to play a tougher Texas?
Well, they have three cupcakes every year.
I'm afraid to play Texas, but I'll play Clemson, Notre Dame. Come on, get over yourself.
Texas like I said, a lot of Big 12 SEC teams like I said. 15 years. So, I mean, I'd like to see it on Labor Day. I love tradition.
I grew up with it. I used to be absolutely adamant that they should play it. But as they try to expand their brand to be more national, I get it. And quite frankly, selfishly, I enjoy the road trips.
Oh, I bet. Great games every week.
You enjoy a road trip to Austin too, OB.
Just to hang out with you guys. And like you said, when we started out coming over there now, nobody over there wants to claim me anymore.
We claim you, dog. We claim you. You know what? It's going to happen, and it's going to be in the Cotton Bowl, and hopefully in a couple of years, a New Year's Six game. They'll put 80,000. No, it won't. They'll put 80,000 people in Jerry World, and it's just going to be a big party, and that will be fun.
So you don't think it's going to happen this year?
Do I think Texas is going to play in the Cotton Bowl? Yeah. No.
I don't think they're good.
I mean, they're still in line for the conference championship, right?
Yeah. But are they going to win it? No.
Okay.
I just win a conference championship. Kirk may think differently. My opinion is no. I think they'll probably lose Iowa State or K-State. They're going to lose one of those two games.
Probably. Maybe both. K-State doesn't even have its quarterback anymore, right?
That doesn't matter. It's in Little Apple. I can't remember the guy's name, but they sprung a surprise starter on Texas in like 07 or 08, and no, it was 07. And beat Texas 45-42. So I believe I got the year right.
I've noticed those Longhorns had a little bit of trouble from time to time with Kansas as well.
Easy time. Easy.
You know what we call Arkansas over here. We call Arkansas our Kansas.
Oh, yeah. My God. That's so fun.
It's been fun.
Oh, man.
I enjoyed it.
All right, dude. Hey, we'll do it again. We won't wait 200 episodes to have you back on. So I don't think we'll last another 200. We'll be happy to last another 200 days at this point. So,
hey, thank you guys for having me on. I always enjoyed talking football with you and arguing with you. And it's been a lot of fun. I sure miss it over there.
Yeah, we miss you too, brother. But we'll chat soon. I'll see you at the – I think they get Ole Miss coming up in a few weeks.
Next game.
The next game, maybe.
Maybe.
The next game might be LSU.
All right. So if Ole Miss is a go, I'll see you down at College Station.
All right. We'll be looking for you.
Okay, brother. Later.
Bye.
On Second Thought.
That will do it for episode 200 of On Second Thought. We got to thank Melanie Hauser and Olin Buchanan for joining us. Thank you guys for hanging out with us for the last 200 episodes, and we hope to give you 200 more. For the Doug Kirk Bowles, I'm Cedric Golden. We'll see you next time.
You've been listening to On Second Thought, powered by Hook'em.com. Join Ced and Kirk every Thursday at lunch for a new episode. Archived episodes are available on iTunes and Google Android Play.